Hi, this is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their outstanding yearly conference at pnwa.org. Well, I get to talk to a lot of writers. I talk to writers of all genres, some of them bestsellers, some of them Pulitzer Prize winners, but one interesting thing about writers is no matter how good a writer you are, you may not actually enjoy talking about writing. For some writers, it's simply what they do, and they aren't interested in talking about it. But that is not the case with my guest today. If you've had the good fortune of reading Laura Munson's memoir, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is, A Season of Unlikely Happiness, or one of her wonderful articles for Author Magazine, you know that Laura can speak with passion and great enthusiasm about writing and the writing life, which makes her the perfect guest for Author to Author, and why I'm so glad to have her on today. And so let's get her on here. My poor computer is trying to get her off hold and get her live, which I think she will be in just a moment.
I'm here.
Ah,
hi, Bill.
There she is. Hello, Laura.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here. You are such a gift to the world of writers, so thank you for your great work.
Thank you so much. You know, I love to help writers. You know how I think to help them, Laura? You know what I did when I tried to start Author? I said to myself, what do you need? What is the magazine you wanted, you would have liked to have read or watched when you were out scouring around? And that's what I made in Author Magazine, which, as a matter of fact, I believe is very similar to how you wrote This Is Not the Story You Think It Is. You were writing the book that you want on your bookshelf. You wanted it on your nightstand, did you not?
That's true. I was going through a rough time in my marriage, and I thought, you know, I don't really read a lot of self-help books. I didn't want to read a book that was specifically spiritual, and I really just wanted to know that I wasn't alone and that there were other people out there who were going through the same sort of thing, no matter what crisis they were in. So I decided to write the book that I wanted to read because I couldn't find one like it.
Perfect. And that's why I started Author. Also, I thought writers can feel so alone. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I did interviews with writers, not to talk so much about the book they've written, although sometimes we do that, but just to talk about what you go through as a writer, so that all the writers, no matter where they are in their writing journey, could see how there are others going through that and how they aren't alone. And come to find out that no matter how much experience or success, quote-unquote, you have had, the challenges remain strangely the same, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do. I mean, it's really about dealing with rejection. I think that has been the way that the publishing world has been my teacher, if you want to call it that.
Sure, no, absolutely.
A great teacher in helping me to understand that as long as I was defining my happiness on my publishing career, I was living in complete insanity, and it took me, since 1988 up until about 4 years ago to finally surrender Dorothy on the whole publishing thing. That's not to say that I didn't want to still get published or that I wasn't actively pursuing publication, but it was a different mindset. I started writing out of gratitude and surrender, and that's when everything changed.
Amazing, isn't it? You know, I was just thinking about rejection and rejection letters and so on, because I'm going to be giving some presentations coming up here in the next month or so. And I thought, you know what makes rejection letters so hard, or not the rejection letters maybe, but the acceptance letters, by which I mean the concept that you will be happy when one of those things comes in your door. I almost think it's that holding out for that makes the rejection letters that much more challenging.
Oh, it's so true, and it's very hard to sell that idea to somebody who hasn't had a book published yet, or because you think, oh, easy for you to say. You've got this brand-new little shiny pink book baby in your hand. But what I have learned is that there's really no destination there other than that you can finally have the trajectory met between what you do in your little office, wherever it is, in my case, Montana, to, you know, the hearts and laps of people internationally. So my book's been published in 9 different countries, and I get to hear from people from all over the world, and that's what matters to me. That's really what makes it all worthwhile. But the rest of it is about getting back to work and knowing what it is to live in that intersection of heart and mind and craft that is writing.
Hey, tell me again, I was just talking to my wife about, she mentioned that great quote you have. It's sort of your, if you had a target above your desk, that
yeah.
quote is the bullseye for your writing. And tell us again what that is.
Well, it's an author statement, and I encourage anybody, I've been leading writing retreats and workshops, which have been so much fun, because like you, I think I have a teaching spirit. I just got back, in fact, from a week in Tulum, Mexico, and co-led a wonderful writing retreat called the Radiant Retreat that my friend Jennifer Shelter puts together every year, and I got to do the writing. And I encouraged each person, whether or not they want to pursue a writing career, to come up with an author statement and pin it to their writing desk or their computer, or just keep it someplace very prominent in their life. It's maybe a safe, happy place, like on your nightstand when you wake up in the morning.
Right.
And it's really a mission statement or a statement of purpose that helps us get back to why we're really sitting here doing this thing all the time alone. And mine is, in fact, I didn't have one for years, and it was
right.
when my agent said she wasn't going to send my stuff out anymore, that I needed a platform, and that she wasn't going to send anything out until I got one, that I put my head down on my, you know, desk and wept, and I thought, what am I doing all these years just sitting here? I've written 14 unpublished novels.
Right.
They're not all good, but I finally thought, you know, this may never happen, so I need to figure out what my intention is here, because it begins with intention. So I wrote down something that actually quite surprised me. What came out was, I write to shine a light on a dim or otherwise pitch black corner to provide relief for myself and others. So suddenly I realized, wow, I'm actually in a place of service on the page. I never knew that. And so once I kind of stopped writing for just me and considered the reader, things started to change.
Yes. It makes a huge difference. You know, the best piece of writing I did in high school, and I wanted to write from very early on. I was writing stories and writing stories, and they were all very self-conscious and clumsy in ways. But the best piece of writing I did was a little three-paragraph speech I read at my high school graduation. I was the editor of my yearbook, and our principal died in the middle of the school year. And so we dedicated the yearbook to him, and we had a special engraved issue of the copy of the yearbook that I was going to give to his wife on stage at the graduation. So I had to write something to say. So I had been writing and writing and writing all these stories, but really with the only thought that I was going to show them to my mom, I was going to show them to my English teacher. You know, that was my audience. Well, suddenly, I was going to have hundreds of people that I was going to have to speak to about a man who had died. And something came up in me, and it was probably the best piece of writing I'd ever done, because suddenly, what would you say, I asked myself, if people actually were going to hear you? What would you say then? And it made all the difference. What would you say if you actually had to say something to me, not say something to someone, not just you want to be a good writer, but if you actually wanted to communicate something, and the issue of being a good writer or a famous writer or a successful writer wasn't the issue, what if you just wanted to communicate, what would you say? And lo and behold, it was the best piece I'd done at that point.
Isn't that interesting? And that doesn't surprise me. And, you know, for a long time I would have argued you on that one. I think I would have said, you know what, to consider your reader is going to jade your writing.
Right.
And I don't, it's not that you're selling out or you're writing what your reader needs to hear, but it is a form of service. And there is something very powerful there when we tell our own story in a way that comes from that place of service and intention. And like I think I told you this the last time we spoke, my favorite piece of fan mail, if you want to call it fan mail, was from a blind woman in Israel. Do you remember me telling you this?
No, I don't
she
think
said it. It's unbelievable. She said because the short version of my book came out in the New York Times first, and she had heard about that essay, and so she. She said, I'm a blind woman from Tel Aviv, Israel, and I've never been married, nor have I had children, but I heard about your book through your essay, and I downloaded it this weekend, and it helped me get through the greatest loss of my life, and that was the death of my seeing eye dog to cancer. And I thought, that is why we write. That is the power of story. It transcends social groups and religions and cultures and goes over oceans and back again. And I just thought, this is why the written word will never die. This is why people will always need books.
Is that not better than any acceptance letter you could ever get? I mean, it's great to have it accepted, but that, I'm sorry, is so much, I mean, obviously it's so much more meaningful. You know, I was thinking about it, Laura. I was thinking about, I have that teacher strain in me, too. And I was thinking about the first time I really understood it. I was still working in restaurants, and there was this guy who was having a really hard time, and he was starting up this little business, and it was just finally starting to happen. He'd been in restaurants a long time, and he wanted out, just like I did, and it was just starting to grow, but he was getting impatient, and his wife, who also worked at the restaurant, came running to me before the shift and said, Bill, Tim wants to quit. You've got to talk to him. He'll listen to you. Please don't let him quit yet. It's not time, right? So I had this task put before me. And so Tim comes in, and he's like, I'm done. I'm just going to get out of here. And something welled up in me, and I said, don't do it. You planted this garden, and you're watering it, and it's growing, but it's not ready to be flourished. It will. Just keep watering. It's not time. And he agreed not to leave, and he thanked me afterwards. But the truth is, I wanted to thank him, because in order to speak to him and say what he needed to hear for him, I had to go into myself and find that part of myself that I was in search of. And I contacted it, and then let it through. So what I gave him, I received myself. And so, yes, it was a gift to him, but it was really just as much for me.
Listen, and you know, this is an interesting thing, I think, for the writers out there who might be listening or who might listen to this later than today. You know, the experience of actually getting that acceptance letter was, I was on my treadmill. My agent called and said, okay, we have a huge book deal. You get to choose between the editor of The Help at Putnam and the editor of The Kite Runner at Riverhead. They're both under the Penguin umbrella. Here's how much each has offered you. You've got 12 hours to make a decision. So I went from being a total beggar to a pretty big chooser overnight. And, of course, I had to call all my writer group friends from my Seattle days, and they're the ones that made the choice for me. But I said, can I just stand here for 1 second and cry? And she goes, yep, that's about all you got, 1 second. So I took my feet off the treadmill, put them on either side of the treadmill, stood there, burst into tears, and she goes, okay, so you got 12 hours. You got to figure it out, okay? This is what this was. This is destination success. I don't know. I'll tell you, the illusion of failure and the illusion of success are both just that. And I love talking to writers about that because I have been in the trenches of failure, what society calls failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've breathed the oxygen of what society deems success. And really, I can't say it enough, there really is no destination. It's back in your office, but on your seat, strapped in, working on your stuff.
Yes. And connecting and to that part
lies.
Of yourself that you think is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, if it's a romance novel and it's valuable, and you know what makes for a great romance novel, connect to it and share it. You know, if that's what you feel, connect to it and share it. But find that part of yourself that you know has value. You know, when I started writing the book I just sent off to my agent, I said, I was writing these novels and I was finally getting sick of them. And I said, okay, Bill, if you could write anything at all, what would it be? And when I did that, I had this image in my head of my hands and they were holding a gift. I mean, I literally could see my hands holding a gift. And as soon as I saw that, I knew the book I wanted to write. But I saw it as, oh, I would love to do it as a gift. And that, and in fact, we just interviewed John Green, the young adult writer who's kind of a YouTube phenom as well as a wonderful novelist. And he, when he chooses his projects, he thinks, what would be the best gift to my readers?
Wow.
And, of course, it has to be a gift to you, too. You have to sense the value in the gift in order to give it, you know. And I think
I always begin with a quirk. Oh, I just interrupted you. Hopefully my mom's not listening. Hi, Mom, if you are. I always begin with a quirk of society, something I'm really interested in. Like I wrote a whole series about a woman with dementia just because I was so curious about climbing into the mind of somebody who was losing her mind. And then that kind of, it's not really a quirk of society, but that's what I call it. That thing that I'm curious about then begets the characters, and then the characters tell the story. And that's not how I don't think most writers do it, but that's perhaps, I mean, I know I'm curious to a fault sometimes, but I really do want to climb into the collective we and see what makes us, capital U, click,
yeah,
kick, and click.
Well, I don't know how, you know, I've heard people say, well, some write character-driven fiction and some don't, but I don't know how you, I mean, I understand this, what we call plot-driven and what we call voice-driven and what we call character-driven. I've heard those broken down, but I don't know how your character can't, well, I know there are books written where the characters kind of don't drive the story, but, I mean, the characters have to be, they have to be driving it forward ultimately because they're the ones feeling the repercussions of what happened, hopefully. All
yes.
that is happening in this plot of yours.
Yes, they know what's at stake.
Yeah.
They're why we care. They're why. In fact, I always feel like when I'm telling a story on the page, whether it's a short story, memoir, or novel, a novel is my real love, I always feel like the character, or in the case of a memoir or a personal essay, it's you, is saying, take my hand. I'm just a little bit braver than you are, maybe just a teeny bit more wise or more curious or experienced, and just come with me. And I promise that we'll try to get through this dark tunnel together. I'll hold the torch. We're going to try to find some light at the end.
Right.
And I think that's a pact that each reader needs to feel that the author is making, whether, again, through herself or himself being the main character or his or her characters. And that's what makes the book really sing. There is that initial pact that usually happens within the first sentence or paragraph where the reader says, okay, I'm going to invest this money or this time or both into reading this piece of work.
Yeah.
And I think if the person who's writing it says, I know so much more than you, and I'm going to go down this tunnel, and you can follow if you want, and I don't really care, then it's not going to work. Go
ahead.
I was just going to say, so in order to find that place as a writer, if there's writers out there who are saying, how am I supposed to be brave when I don't even know where we're going?
Right.
I think the answer to that is write with authority. And then it's something that I think I ripped off from you the last time we talked on the phone.
Okay.
Write with compassion and responsibility.
Yes, compassion.
And if you write with compassion, responsibility, and authority, then your reader is going to go follow you off a cliff, I think.
Yeah, compassion, I cannot stress enough how important compassion is, because if you write the sort of books that have villains, and memoirs are interesting, by the way, in that you can't have villains really in memoirs, it just doesn't work, which says something about life, but if you write the sort of stories that do have villains, and they're fine, you even have to have compassion for them, because
yeah.
everyone, you know, who was I was just talking to? Sarah Vowell, who wrote Unfamiliar Fishes and Wordy Shipmates, she's on The Daily Show, and she's pretty funny, and she was talking about the fellow who wrote, I can't remember the book now, but he was talking about Hitler in his book and how Hitler woke up every day believing he was making the world a better place. Now, he didn't, obviously, but he was under the impression that he was. And to some degree, you've got to find compassion for everyone, no matter how loathsome they are, because they think. No one does anything unless they think it's the right thing. I don't buy it. I don't think we deliberately do the wrong, quote-unquote, thing.
Yeah, I agree with
wrong,
that.
But I'm yet to see it happen that way.
No, I think I do believe in people's basic goodness. And, in fact, the last book I was writing, and I had to put it on pause because this other book felt more important to write. But I had the main character is this diabolical, scheming, strategic temptress of a woman
uh-huh.
who's trying to basically take down these two innocent farm boys from Montana.
Uh-huh.
And it was so interesting having her be the protagonist and to try to find empathy for her, because I wanted to call her bad or wrong,
sure.
and I wanted to call the boys right. But it turns out that they flip-flop in the middle of it, and it was so much fun for me to step out of right and wrong and good and bad and into just the human creature. And I look forward to going back to that book, because I think it's a fun little trick to play on yourself as the writer and the reader to have it be so cut and dry that she's bad and they're good, and then to experience yourself empathizing with the villain. It's a powerful experience, I think, for both reader and writer.
Well, you know, I did this thing. I took this chapter out, but there was a powerful moment in my childhood when my second stepmother, I had a, well, she wasn't, she was my father's wife, but I never really lived with her. But I went to visit them, and she made me, she was big on eating everything on your plate. And I had to eat these mashed potatoes, which I was a very picky eater, and my mother never made me eat everything. But she made me eat these mashed potatoes, and I threw up. And then she made me keep eating them after I threw up, right?
Oh, no.
So, horrible, horrible. And so, and her, and for years, she was the evil stepmother. I even was, and went to Disneyland with her. I was such a naive kid. I was such a sweet kid. I was sort of sweet. 9 years old. I said, isn't it funny? We're in Disney World, and you're the evil stepmother. Isn't that funny?
Oh.
This was, it didn't go over so well. But when I was rewriting this memoir, I took this chapter out, but it was a great exercise because I looked at life from her point of view, which I had never done in 30 years. And I saw how, in many ways, she and I were so similar, that my tightness was like her tightness, and how when she was looking at me, she was seeing a version of herself, and that was probably why she made me do it. Not because she was evil, but because she was trying to open my experience up and make me not be quite so tight with my food. You know, it was a mistake, but I'm sure that was why she was doing it. And only in writing did I was able to see life from her point of view, finally, after all these years. I wouldn't let it go. She was bad, and that was that. You know, I kept that way for a long time.
And what a great example of, I think it's Annie Dillard who says, I write to understand.
Yeah.
I think it's Annie. Well, I mean, I've thought of that too. I mean, that's what you did. You wrote to understand. And I think a lot of writers begin with that. And then it grows from there. And then it becomes a real, you know, passion for words and story. But I think it does kind of have to begin with this general curiosity for what makes people good, bad, cruel, loving, you know?
Yes. You've mentioned your novels. You had put one on hold to just finish one, and when last I was in contact with you, you were in a rush to finish it. Did you finish it in the time you expected to?
I did not, but I actually worked on it today. I've been working on it. I wrote it breathlessly, and I've never ever done that before. I always sort of loop around so that I write about 5 to 8 pages a day, and then at the end of the day, after the kids are picked up and I'm back at home before dinner all begins, I take a bath and I edit what I've written, and then the next day I have that launch pad, and it brings me right back into it again. And I also do what Hemingway said to do in his book on writing, to write just a little bit farther than where you want to, you know, so finish your chapter and then write like the first paragraph of the next chapter, even if you don't use it, because it helps you to get back into it again.
Yes.
Well, I have never, ever, ever written anything any other way than that. But this winter, I actually wrote straight, no outline, no idea where I was going, except for I knew the overall idea of beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I got to, well, I'm on about page 270 today, and about a month ago, I realized somewhere along the line, the main character lost a baby and 3 dogs.
Oh, nice. Well,
isn't that nice?
That's what had to happen, I guess. But this is the first draft. Are you a big rewriter?
I'm a big rewriter, and I'm I turn in a very clean edited copy, if I must say so myself. So my first version is pretty clean. But I had lunch with the writer Rick Bass in Missoula a couple weeks ago. And he's published many, many well-read books. And I said, I'm writing this book right now, and I'm a little nervous because I'm truly writing it breathlessly, and it's meant to be read breathlessly. He said, I did that one time. I said, what happened? He said, oh, no, I was afraid you were going to ask that. He said, it got published, and no one read it.
Well, that's one story.
That's one story. I know, and that's another thing, that just because you've had a book that lands on the New York Times bestseller list doesn't make you exempt from rejection and doubt and all those things. And that's why really knowing your practice matters. And in fact, when I was meeting with all the top guns at Penguin and looking out of the office at the Statue of Liberty, I said to pretty much the doyen of all marketing and publicity in New York City, you know, I know I'm supposed to be scared out of my mind right now, and I'm not. Because thank God this didn't happen when I was 25 or even 35. Thank God I'm in my 40s, because I know who I am on the page. I know myself as a woman. And I really believe in my work. One of the publicity people turned to the other one and said, we don't have any authors in their 20s or 30s, do we? They said, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I'll
so,
bet you know, do.
I would have liked the memo then, you know, because I spent my 20s and 30s yearning for this success, in quotes. And I'm glad it didn't happen back then, or I would have been deer in the headlights.
I think it can be pretty intimidating. I have interviewed some very young writers who were, you know, published in their 20s, and usually they almost don't know what's happened to them in a way. It's not that they're not enjoying and not doing well, but they don't even understand what, which maybe is just as well. You know, and perhaps they, I think to some degree they hadn't built it up to be, you know, that was one of the big challenges I had. I hadn't made it into this big thing. And so when I started meeting all the writers and speaking to them and saying, oh, I see they're just human beings after all, they're not up on some pedestal somewhere, then it made it more possible for me to do it. Because I had to see their humanness. I had to see it because I had not made, you know, because there is something special about when you read a book that you love, you know, when you read a book that, because I really feel like, and there's not that many of them, but when you read one where you close the book and you feel just a little bit changed, you know, I've had that experience, where I view the world just a little bit different and to some degree humanity a little bit different because somebody wrote this. You know, it's a kind of mystical experience, somewhat sort of divine, and it's very easy to make the person responsible for that a kind of deity, although you know they're not intellectually, but yet they provided you with this experience, which was kind of holy, and to be able to say, A, they're just people, and B, I would like to be one of those, because for me, I can't think of a better experience than to be able to give that to someone else. It requires a shift in what a human being is.
Exactly, and I think that's why I'm so keen on doing these writing retreats, because I really am not interested in being put on a pedestal, and I know what it's like to put authors on a pedestal because I've been doing it for years, namely Jim Harrison.
Did you get to meet him?
And that, I did, and that's a funny story. We don't have enough time for me to tell it, but I mean, I think you can kind of worship a writer on the page, and but it's important to see their humanity, and if, especially if you want to learn from them. So, like, I'm doing my first just 3-day intensive workshop in Montana this fall, and I'm doing one on the Oregon coast, and I'm really, it's a great way to balance out the writing life. Not everybody's cut out for it as a writer, but to me, it just strikes that perfect balance of being in a creative person sort of in the winter, and then in the summer being more of a writer who's in a place of service. And I think we do need to find a different paradigm. I'm sick of the tortured artist paradigm. I want us to move into the empowered artist paradigm.
Yes, absolutely.
I have found that, and the writing community is incredibly generous if you show up that way.
Yes.
And that's kind of who, well, that's not kind of, that's who you are, and that's who I am, and it just, I hope, just puts more and more empowerment out there to people who feel so desperate as writers.
Yes, well, and think of it this way. To some degree, Laura, I know it's true of me, you and I are so similar in certain ways, because I, you know, I can't match you book for book, but I might be able to match you rejection for rejection, for and certainly year for year, because I spent 20 years toiling away and getting the letters. And I know that it was very hard on me at the time, but I know it has equipped me to do something now that I don't think I would have had. I would not have had the level of compassion I do now, if I have any at all. It came from that suffering. And what I did to myself, I mean, no one did it to me, by the way. If you had looked at me in my life, you would have thought, well, you know, all right, so he's not selling the book, but geez, look at his beautiful wife, and he's got a job, and so on. But that taught me something that I couldn't have learned otherwise. And so I know it's a cliche, but I am actually grateful for that. You know, I wouldn't be what I am without it.
That's right. Me too. I agree.
It's absolutely true. Well, I just heard a little bird in my voice tell me that our time is almost up. Laura, it was too short, but thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. And if anybody out there is interested in learning more about what I do, you can find me at lauramunson.com. And I hope you all support Author Magazine. I know I do. It's a wonderful resource for writers. So thanks for that, Bill.
Yes, lauramunson.com, and she's got an excellent blog, which is These Here Hills. God dang it. Okay, These Here Hills. It's excellent. And if you ever, and she does write for us for Author Magazine, and the articles are always fabulous. Thanks again, Laura.
Thanks, Bill. Have a nice day in Seattle.
All right, you too. And thank you, everybody who listened in. I can see you there, and I still got one guest holding, you wanted to talk. Unfortunately, we couldn't get to you. I'm so sorry, but thanks for everybody for listening in. It's been another great show. Next week, who am I talking to? Gosh, I can't even remember. It doesn't matter. It's going to be somebody fabulous. In the meantime, remember that the books you write and the lives you lead, they're one and the same. What it takes to write the book you most want to write is what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. It's true. So go do what you love, everybody. You can't go wrong.